Hi there, I'm Chuck Cellier, the director of Silent Night, Deadly Night, and you're listening to the Gut Munchers podcast.
Hey, it's episode 8 of the Gut Munchers podcast. I'm John, and with me is my co-host from Japan, Jason, the animal, Pain!
Good morning, Gut Muncher Land.
Well, they might be listening to this in the middle of the night.
Well, it's morning here, and that's all that matters to me, because I'm kind of, you know, all that matters.
Well, but see, you know, I know a lot of our listeners like to pop the Gut Munchers podcast on when they're romancing their ladies, because my tones helps to loosen it up and get the mood going.
Oh, whoa, watch out. This is a family-friendly show, I thought.
Family-friendly? When the hell did that happen?
Oh, you didn't know? I've been promoting this all over Disneyland, Tokyo Disneyland, and we're kind of a big deal there now.
Oh. Well, F them.
Oh, my gosh. No. But, yeah, this is 8 is a great episode, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, we got a good show. We're going to have an episode of Sensei Cinema with Steve. We got Ed going to be talking to some Silent Night, Deadly Night. We've got an interview with the director of Silent Night, Deadly Night, Chuck Cellier. And you and I are doing some reviews. We're going to be doing reviews for two classic movies. And that would be Fright Night with one of my personal favorites and heroes, Roddy McDowall. And, of course, the classic, the amazing, the wonderful, the iconic Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
That is correct. I cannot wait.
Yes. Did you know in space no one can eat ice cream?
Yeah, I also heard in space no one can hear you scream.
Oh, they can hear you scream.
Oh, can they?
Yeah, you just can't eat ice cream.
Really, Scott's a liar then.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, liar. But yeah. So I think we got a pretty exciting show.
Yeah, I do too.
But before we start, I want to talk about a couple things. And this is a monthly podcast, so this isn't cutting news. Or I shouldn't say this isn't breaking news or cutting edge or anything like that. By now, everyone's already heard. But recently, there's been the passing of two iconic actors that I think Jason and I are both fans of. First one I want to talk about is David Carradine, who passed away under mysterious circumstances. That was very sad. We just recently talked a lot about him when we did the Kill Bill show. Was that last month?
Yeah, that was last month, I believe.
Yeah, so we just did a Kill Bill show, and I think that you and I both really thought he was a great actor. I think we talked quite a bit about it. But, I was bummed when I found out about it. He just seemed like a really cool guy.
You know? Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think so. I mean, I know I kind of gave a different opinion when I heard about him taking the place of Warren Beatty for Bill, but that doesn't take away from his performance in that movie, and I think that, you know, he did a great job, and I think that also, you know, Quentin Tarantino in true Quentin Tarantino style kind of plucked him up out of obscurity again, and he started getting a lot more work. And if you go back and look at, like, 2004, 2005, before that, you know, he wasn't really doing much. He kind of fell off the grid, you know, not really doing things. And then after Kill Bill, you know, he was doing tons of stuff. Lots of cameos in movies are, like, just short or glorified cameos in some respects. But he's really starting to get a lot more work. And so, yeah, it's unfortunate that he died. And I just wanted to say, you know, everybody kind of goofs and makes fun of the situation that seems to be the way he died. It seems like the truth's coming out more now that it might have been like a sex game gone wrong that he was performing himself.
Did you hear that? Sorry about the dog's audience. Jason was giving a heartfelt comment, and one of my dogs acted like a retard. So, but sorry about that.
No, it's okay. But I mean, you know, it seems like, you know, it might have been something that, you know, is going to look really bad. I mean, for him in the long run, because people are going to think about, when they think about David Carradine, they won't think about the actor or the great cult actor or, you know, martial art, you know, practitioner or whatever. They'll think about him, you know, hung up in his closet with fishnets and a wig on, naked, playing with himself. And I mean, you know, we can all make jokes and laugh about it, but the fact of the matter is I don't think anybody wants to be known the last dying days and minutes on Earth. That's the way they went, and they totally forget about everything else he's done. So it's unfortunate, you know, and hopefully maybe more truth, like you said, John, is still kind of evolving. Maybe something else will come out, and it might not be as bad as it looks. But, yeah, it's unfortunate, but it doesn't take away from his body of work, that's for sure.
And I'm not trying to make a joke about this, but this is how I really feel. If the guy's 73 years old and he can still get his freak on, more power to him. How many 73-year-old guys are going to be getting their freak on? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, really in a Bangkok hotel of all places. So, you know, who knows? But and then the other guy you wanted to talk about, you and I both have a little bit of more knowledge about this individual. So who was the next guy you want to mention, John?
Well, and then the great Don Edmonds, director. I think he's probably best known as the director of Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS. He also recently passed away. And, I mean, I know I've met him on two occasions at Wasteland. I know you've met him at least once. I actually have an Ilsa DVD signed up by Don, and I've got to sit and watch him in a couple of different panels and talk to him at his table. And I can tell you, Don Edmonds was a great, great guy, real blast. He, I don't know, he's just somebody that I really I always remember meeting because he was just awesome. But I was really disappointed and sad to hear that he had passed away. I think like a week before Carradine did. So,
right.
And his, I believe it was cancer, but I'm not entirely sure. But he was awesome. I mean, you know, and I'll give you a chance to talk here because you also met him. But he was one of those guys that I thought was just a really cool dude and really good to the fans and just enjoyed what he was doing.
I mean, totally. And I think it was cool that, you know, Dead Pit probably got the last, at least known to most people's knowledge, interview with Don before his passing. And from what they said, they think it, you know, he must have did the interview and then not too long after that found out he had cancer, if that's what has happened, and just died. It didn't take long at all, so it's kind of happened all of a sudden. The two things that I want to mention about Don, I did meet him about, I guess, a year and a half ago at Cinema Wasteland in Ohio, and one thing was I went to his table. He was kind of sitting there. At that point, it was kind of a lull in his line, so I went over, we talked. He was really cool, down to earth, and I was talking to him about, you know, being a director and just directing. He just told me some, you know, tidbits about directing and what was it like and things like that. And I thought it was really cool because, you know, he just talked like a normal guy, and he was just really funny. I think that's the one thing, if you talk to Don Edmonds, that you take away from is the guy is just really funny, and he's a straight shooter, which I always like about people. And, you know, even if it was kind of offensive or shocking, he didn't really care. He just said, you know, that's how I am. And I think that was really cool, and that goes to one of the stories he talked about at the panel. He had like an Ilsa panel with him and Diane Thorne, and then I think Diane Thorne's husband, Howard Maurer.
Yeah.
But the one thing that he said was really interesting or funny, I thought, was at the time that Ilsa was released, you know, it was coming up against a lot of, you know, hatred, and, you know, the title was definitely against the film in lots of places. They don't want to see it, and they thought it was, you know, trash or whatever. And they said he hired a girl, I guess, to pretend to be Ilsa in like an opened up, like, you know, like a, you know, chopped, you know, hood, no hood on like a Cadillac or something to bring the movie into New Jersey.
Yeah.
Or something like that. And there was like people protesting the movie, and the people were like throwing stuff at this girl, like trying to like knock her out, you know, from the streets or the sidewalks. And they're trying to like, you know, like, you know, Nazi, you know, exploitation films are terrible, and, you know, the Holocaust, this, you know, and I mean, they're like throwing, like, I don't know, rocks and cans, and like, you know, and then Don's just telling this story, and it was just so funny because he's like, you know, everybody's like freaking out and scared and running and trying to hide from, you know, this angry mob of people. And I mean, you know, it's just, you know, he just had a way about stories and just being very blunt and said, you know, about, you know, his viewpoints on things. And so, anyway, I just thought it was really cool to meet Don Edmonds. He's a really nice guy. I also had an autograph by him, which I will probably show on a YouTube video here in the near future. But anyways, it was a real sad to hear him passing as well.
I also have some good stuff signed by him. And my Ilsa DVD, I do have to show people. show people my Elsa DVD at some point that I have all signed up. So someday I'll do a YouTube video with my autographs and show everybody what I have. But, yeah, I tell you, man, you know, being fans of exploitation films and like I am, and fans of stuff in the 70s and 80s, you start to see a lot of these actors and a lot of these directors, they're getting up there in age. And, you know, you sit there and you look at it, and then you suddenly realize one after another, they keep going. And you lose them, and they pass away. And that means, you know, I'm not trying to be morbid, but I tell you, when I'm at a show and I'm looking to get autographs from somebody, I do think about it.
Oh, yeah.
I do think about it.
I think you're lying if you don't.
Yeah, it's like, this might be the only chance I ever get to meet these people, so I had better take the time to do it. So,
yeah, definitely. That's definitely the way I think, and I've heard many, many convention regulars say those same things whenever they get a chance to meet an older lady or gentleman from yesteryear. They usually try to hit them up first just on the pure fact that you just never know when their time's up. I mean, you know, obviously none of us know that, but especially with time's not on their side if they're, you know, older. So anyways, but that's the numbers game for sure.
Well, when it just means you got to appreciate it when you got them.
Definitely, definitely.
So, but it's going to be a good show. It's going to be a good show. I'm actually feeling very energetic and kind of – I'll warn you right now, Jason. You know, the beginning segment here was a little bummer because we had a couple of sad things to talk about. But I tell you, I am so freaking hyperactive today that we are going to have a crazy show. Crazy show.
It's going to be crazy.
It's going to be out of control. So
I'm bucking up right now.
I think the first thing we're going to do is we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I think we're going to hear the Chuck Sellier interview. We'll be back right after this with the interview, and you're listening to the Gut Munchers podcast. My first question would be, it's kind of the question I'm always interested in asking people. What got you into making movies, and what was that? Was there one particular thing that really got you interested that you wanted to do it?
Well, all the way through high school, I wanted to be a writer. And my mother and everybody else kept trying to discourage me from being a writer. And so when I got out of high school, a group of friends and I, you know, typical filmmaker story, we rented some 16-millimeter cameras because it's all we could afford, and we wanted to make a movie. And the only movie we could make, because we couldn't afford any actors, was an animal picture. And so we went into the woods and we filmed an animal picture. This is like in 1968 in that area. So we got done with it that summer. Obviously, you film in the summer because the winter you can't get in the woods. And we edited it together and we took it to some theaters in the November area. And the theaters all laughed at us. They said, "Hey, guys, wait a minute. First of all, you're in 16 and we're in 35 millimeter. And secondly, we don't do documentaries in theaters. We do dramatic shows. So we were very disappointed, but like a group of enthused film and young enthused filmmakers, we went out and rented some 16-millimeter cameras, seven 16-millimeter cameras, because there were seven of us. And we, in January, right after Christmas, we started showing our animal picture in meeting halls, in Elks Lodges, and we'd put posters up everywhere in town. We'd take radio interviews where we could. And we started distributing our show in that fashion, and so we did that all of January and February, and along about March the 7th, Al Pedersen, who was then and was until he retired recently our money man for many, many years, he called us into his hotel room and he said, "Guys, I've got $250,000 under my bed. Let's go home." And that began our filmmaking experience.
Excellent. So did that lead to the other projects then, or later on? Or
yeah, I think that I guess I first became what you would call famous with The Life and Times of Grizzly Adams, a book I had written early in right after I'd left high school. And finally, in 1974, we filmed that book into a movie, and it did, I think, $35 million in its opening weekend. So that sort of was the first time that anyone ever heard of me.
And I was interested, because that was one of my next questions, is, first of all, I think that was the first movie where you guys worked with, or I don't know, Sun International, or...
Well, what happened was that... this group of seven filmmakers I'm talking about, one of them knew a fellow who owned Technicolor, Schick Razor Blade Company, Paper Mate Pen Company, all these things. A guy by the name of Patrick Frawley. And so he introduced us to Patrick. Patrick became my mentor literally till the day he passed away. And Patrick funded us with enough money to really start doing what you would call dramatic pictures. And Grizzly Adams was our first shot at a dramatic picture in 1974, if my memory is correct. And Patrick was one of the owners of our company at that time, which was called... Sun Classic Pictures, later became International Pictures, and then finally evolved into Grizzly Adams Productions.
Cool. So you were the producer, and you wrote Grizzly Adams. Were you still like heavily involved in the day-to-day of shooting it? And also...
Back then, you got to remember, back then, by the time we were doing Grizzly Adams, we only had 14 people. So we did everything.
So how did when you were when you guys were casting for the movie, did you always kind of, or was Dan Haggerty a slam dunk, or I just interested in how he was cast, because I'm also a big fan of his, and I know he did a bunch of odd things in the 60s.
Dan Haggerty started with us as an animal trainer, and what happened was. When you shoot animal pictures, you roll the cameras, and then the animal trainers would release the animals, and they'd do their thing. And then at the end of the scene, the animal trainers would release the animals. Well, Patrick saw Dan Haggerty because he was at the beginning, at the end of each of the takes, and he said, "Boy, that guy's got a good look." And so when it came time to do The Life and Times of Grizzly Adams, Patrick said, "Hey, why don't we use Dan as Grizzly Adams?" And that's the way that all happened.
Great. And then I guess after doing so well, you guys did a television show version of it, and that's what I remember watching a lot as a kid. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, in 1974 we did the movie. It was a huge success. In 1977, Paul Klein, who was head of NBC at that time, came to me and said, would you guys do a weekly television series about Grizzly Adams? Now, you have to remember, at that time, every movie we were doing was doing millions of dollars. And we, for instance, The Life and Times of Grizzly Adams, we spent $124,000 making it in 1974, and it did millions. So we had a company that was really successful and a lot of cash flow. And so it was a struggle for us to decide to do television. It's fortunate that we did for something that happened later on. But anyway, we finally made the decision to do the show as a television series in 1977. So then we did the series for several years. When the show went off the air, it was still doing a 32 share on Wednesday night. NBC has never done as well since then, and all the years since then, they've never done as well as we did when we went off the air. And we went off the air, you may remember, because of a motorcycle accident that Dan Haggerty got into.
Yeah, I remember that as a kid. It was one of my favorite shows growing up. After The Life and Times of Grizzly Adams, one of the things that I always remembered watching growing up was a lot of the really great sort of documentary-type things you guys shot. One of my favorites was The Mysterious Monsters, or I guess it was Bigfoot and the Mysterious. How did, first of all, how did that sort of come about, and what kind of market were you targeting? And then in the case of, like, The Mysterious Monsters and some of the other ones you did, I know you worked with Peter Graves and Raymond Burr narrated one of them. What was it like working with people like that?
Well, first of all, what happened was in the early what we did is we evolved from taking shows into meeting halls, into Elks Lodges and all that, into renting theaters. And we invented at that time what was called the four-wall distribution system, which was very big in the 70s and early 80s. And in that, you rented the theater for a fixed fee for the whole week. You put your own cashier in the theater, and you took all the money out. So the theater said to us, yeah, guys, you can do that, but we're used to having a short along with the movie, and it sells more popcorn and more candy and stuff like that, which they got to keep. And so we went, oh, yeah, what do we do for a short? And someone on our staff knew this guy named, I think Patterson was his name, who had shot this footage of the Bigfoot monster. And we bought the footage. And we made a short. We made that into a full feature. What we did was the first thing we did was UFO Fact or Fiction as a short.
Okay.
And that was hugely successful. And so then we did the Patterson footage as a short. And we found that people were coming into the theater to see the short. And that's when we decided to make it into a full feature, Bigfoot, the Mysterious Monster, or the Mysterious Monsters. I've done over 600 shows, and the titles sometimes escape me these days after 34 years. But it was something, some kind of title like that. Now, also in 1975, I picked up the Von Däniken book, Church of the Gods.
Mm-hmm.
And we made that into a movie, and it was hugely successful. We also increased the book sales, so Von Däniken was very happy. And so what you've got is sort of a stumbling start. We had to do shorts. Basically, at that time, you would consider us an animal production company just evolving into dramatic films. And then along with the dramatic films, they want shorts. And so the shorts led us to buy different things, which we then made into feature films. And so what we did was we proved that people would go to the theater to see documentaries at that time. And I remember of the seven of us that started the seven filmmakers, five left, and Al Pedersen and I stayed. Al just retired 3 years ago, and I'm still with the company. But the other five went out and got jobs in Hollywood eventually. Three of them became heads of studios, and two of them became heads of networks. So I ended up with buddies that were at the top of the film business for many years. One of them was Frank Wells, who became president of Warner Brothers. And back then, I was the youngest guy on the film crew, so I had the nickname of Kid. And in 1977, in that area, we did a show called In Search of the Dark. That was the name of it. And it was based upon some sightings that people had seen Noah's Ark up on Mount Ararat. And we bought footage from a Frenchman named Navarra. It was black and white, who in 1955 had photographed a piece of the Ark and had photographed he and his son pulling a big piece of wood up out of the it's a glacier up there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we put all that into a movie, and we released it in the fall of, I think it was 77. I walked into my office. At that time, my office was in Los Angeles. Later on, we moved to Utah because we were doing so many shows every year that we just moved all our offices to where the production facility was. But at that time, I was in L.A., and I walked into my office one morning, and there was this big crate in front of my desk. And I asked my secretary, "What's this?" And she says, "It was just delivered from Warner Brothers." And so we got a maintenance guy up, and we pried this crate open. And inside of it was this beautiful, beautiful bronze Noah's Ark. I have it on my desk to this day. And I speak at a lot of film schools and writing schools, and I'll take that Ark with me and set it down there and tell this story. So what happened was, when we said we were going to release Noah's Ark to the theater, Frank Wells from Warner Brothers called me on the phone and said, "Kid, you've done it this time. Okay, so you've done some things, and they've been hits, and they've made some money, but you got to understand, they can get religious programming at that time on Sunday morning, and they aren't going to go pay a big $1.30, which is what we charged in the theaters at that time, to see this." Well, the show broke, and I mean, it did many, many millions of dollars in its first week, went on to be a big hit. And as a result, Frank sent me that bronze Noah's Ark along with a note, "You did it again."
It's funny you mention that story, because my mother actually took me to see that on opening night. So I actually saw it
in the
theater.
Anyway, that was the way we evolved into what I would call two lines of programming, which we do to this day. Now, what happened to us, not to get too long-winded on that area, is that we were running along, and we were four-walling theaters like crazy, ran our company up to about $108 million a year, and lost in 1982. And in 1982, President Ronald Reagan was in office, and he had been big friends with the two guys that ran Universal for many years. And Universal wanted to own a theater chain, and they were prohibited under the 1950 agreement with the Justice Department that said no studio can own a theater. And so they got President Reagan to void this agreement with the Justice Department, and they instantly bought Cineplex Odeon. Now, within that 6 months after that consent decree was vacated, every major studio, including Orion, so seven studios, each bought a theater chain, and they all took on the new policy of no four-walling. Within a six-month period, we went from $108 million to zero because we couldn't rent the theaters anymore. Now, fortunately, and I told you this earlier, in 1977, we did a contract with NBC, which was still going in 82. And so we got knocked out of theatrical business, and so we went full-time into television production, which is where we have basically been to this day, with a few exceptions of theatrical shows that we've done. So now in the 90s, along comes reality shows, and reality became king in television. Well, we've been doing reality since UFO Factor Fiction and Mysterious Monsters and Noah's Ark. That was right down our alley. And so that's what we did basically through the 90s was reality shows.
Excellent. I just want to get back to a question that I had asked, you guys managed to get some really, what I think are really, really cool and incredibly interesting actors to narrate a lot of your stuff. Like Peter Graves, I think, did the Mysterious Monsters, or Bigfoot the Mysterious Monsters. What was it like working with somebody like Peter Graves? And also Raymond Burr did, I think, The Amazing World of Psychic Phenomena. Do you have any, were they hard to get, and any interesting stories?
None of them were hard to get, and they were willing to do those kinds of shows. Had really never done them before because we're going theatrical, and they had never been able to do a theatrical of that nature before, so they're all willing to do it. And the beauty of that was because we were doing basically two types of shows, dramatic shows and documentaries, we made a number of friendships at that stage with actors that we were able to take into dramatic shows. You know, Darren McGavin, we did a dramatic show in 1980 called Hangar 18. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those guys that were in our different documentaries started showing up. All those guys started showing up in our dramatic shows.
Cool. What was and he's actually, it's funny you mentioned that because I had another question about him. Darren McGavin was a particular favorite of mine. I was a huge fan of Kolchak the Night Stalker. What was he like to work with?
Darren and I became best friends. We worked together for many years. You know, he just passed away 18 months ago, and we worked together all the way through my career and later through in his later career. And he was really, really fun to work with. And all these different actors that we worked with, Raymond Burr, Peter Graves, they all were so professional and could look at the material and they just deliver the material, but they added something to the material that we weren't expecting. And I can't think. I'm trying to think. I hear all these horror stories about actors that cause all these problems. I've had some funny things happen, and I had several funny things happen, for instance, on Silent Night, Deadly Night. But I've never had, to my memory, a negative thing happen. All the actors we work with have just been wonderful.
On your... on the list of films that you've worked on, there was one that I actually have a VHS copy of, and I haven't had a chance to watch yet. But it looks really interesting. It's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. that you did with Jeff Goldblum and Steve Allen and Gary Coleman. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's kind of a really and honestly, actually, when I was preparing for the interview, I actually tracked down a copy of this once I saw it. I never knew it existed.
Well, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, in addition to Jeff Goldblum and Meg Foster, also in it was Dick Butkus. If you remember him, he was a linebacker for Chicago. And I, of all the actors I think that I ever worked with, he was the one that I was most thrilled in see on set. And he was nothing like you think of, you know, this linebacker who was able to devastate everybody. He was the kindest and gentlest man, and he loved to play poker. So he tried to get all of us into games on set or at night, and so the whole time that we shot Sleepy Hollow, everybody was playing poker all the time.
Cool. We already mentioned Hangar 18. I noticed that you also did another movie that I actually own on VHS that I absolutely love, and it took me forever to track a copy down, and that was The Boogans you guys had made. That's a great
I wrote a movie. Book. Our production facility for many years was in Park City, Utah. And Park City, Utah had been an old mining town. And we had taken over a lot of the old mining buildings and converted them into wardrobe, set design buildings. And so I became very enamored with mining. And I toured all the mines in the area. There was still one working silver mine when we were working there. And the old miners, all the retired miners, would show up at this place on Main Street, and they all talk about this monster that they had never encountered, but they heard about over the years, and they felt that this monster had come up from the deep, and that a group of miners had one time broken into this cavern and let them loose. And they had sort of taken on the mine and then gotten out and taken on the town. So I wrote a book called The Boogans, which we made into a movie, I'd say in about 82, in that area, about this monster that came up from the mines.
Excellent. I actually have that book, too. I have the book and the VHS. And that actually brings me to an interesting question before I'm going to hand it here shortly off to Ed to talk a little bit about some of your later movies. But there's an amazing volume of, the documentaries and The Boogans and Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And I've never seen them on DVD. I was just really interested because I know there's a lot of people like me who would just fall all over themselves to buy DVDs of these. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The Boogans, first of all, a lot of those early shows, I mean, when you've been at it 34 years, you change technologies over the years. And a lot of those early shows were VHS releases. They were.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, when DVDs came in, many of them were considered by distributors and retailers to be dated, so they didn't want them in DVD. Now, Boogans was released 7 years ago, I'd say, in DVD for a couple of years. So it's out and around. Hangar 18 was released on DVD. It's out and around. But most of these shows were before the DVD era and just never, it would cost money to remaster them and to get them into DVD, and it was felt that there wasn't an interest anymore. I mean, surely you realize that us guys starting out, at the time, we felt it was good filmmaking, but looking back on, you look at Grizzly Adams, made in 1974, it's very rudimentary compared to the shows that we do today. And so some of them, you know, just aren't worth putting on DVD.
Well, I would just like to say, I think you're selling yourself a little short there, because I love these old movies, and I know there's a lot of us fans out there that just absolutely like the Grizzly Adams and a lot of these. I mean, I understand you're better at your job now, but those are still really great. Those are awesome films.
Oh, thank you. You're very, very kind. But we have gotten better and better over the years.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna hand things off to my good friend Ed here. He's going to talk to you a little bit about some of the later stuff.
I want to first ask you about Silent Night, Deadly Night. And it's a film that created a ton of controversy during its release and prior to its release. How did it come about for you to direct the film?
Well, as I've said earlier, we had a contract for many years with NBC. And one of the fellows that worked under the president, Paul Klein, was a fellow named Jeff Sagansky. Jeff left NBC and went on to become, actually president of many different companies, but he left NBC and became president of TriStar. And Jeff and I have been friends to this day. He went on to be president of after TriStar, CBS, and after CBS, he went to Sony and became vice chair, and then he became president of PAX. And all through, every time he went to a different place, he called me and had me do shows for him. And I was even under contract to PAX for 7 years. But anyway, Jeff left NBC and went to TriStar, and he had a young producer who had never, ever produced a show before, a guy by the name of Ira Barmack. Ira had brought to him a book, the title of which was Sleigh Ride, and Ira wanted to make this book into a movie. Now, at that time, all the different slasher movies were out, and every one of them was successful. Halloween, Friday the 13th, I'm talking about the first original ones. Mm-hmm. So Jeff greenlighted the show to be a show that TriStar would do. But he wasn't about to let Ira go off on his own and do it. And so he called me, and he said, I know this is a little wild for you, and you always do your own thing, but would you do me the favor of directing this show, and basically what you're going to be is you're going to be the producer-director, because this young producer doesn't know a whole lot, hasn't done a lot. And at that time, my crew was between shows. And if you know film crews, they whine when they're between shows. And so our next show wasn't ready to mount yet, and so I called Jeff back and said, all right, if you can do it within this window, I'll direct the show for you, because my crew needs the work. And so that's how we got into Sleigh Ride, became Silent Night, Deadly Night, and that's how I ended up directing that show. And there's a number of interesting things that happen on Silent Night, Deadly Night. I know you want to talk about the controversy, but from a filmmaking point of view, there were some breakthrough things that were sort of discovered, creative kinds of things that were sort of discovered and went on to be used by the whole industry on that movie. But to get to the before we get into the production of it and everything, obviously the controversy was that people thought it wasn't actually the storyline of the show, but people thought we had Santa became a slayer. Well, it actually wasn't. What it was a guy posing as Santa, was holding up stores, and that's how the story began. But when the movie came out, it had a huge first week. And it was picketed by the PTA and by mothers, and everybody said that we were doing Santa in. Because I'm going by memory now. I could be slightly wrong about this, but TriStar at the time was about to release another financing or another round of stock sales or something, and they didn't want the controversy. So TriStar pulled the picture after 1 week, if I remember, or 10 days or something like that, if I remember correctly.
I'm glad you mentioned that, actually, because one of the things I wanted to mention to you is from what I could find in the research and everything, prior to the film being released, there was a pretty strong television campaign for it with the trailer showing on TV, and some of the trailers are a little bit. They don't necessarily portray the movie. It seems like there's a little bit being kept behind to make people come to the theater and see it. Do you think that TV campaign actually hurt you guys because a lot of people got on their soapbox and started saying that you guys were trying to make Santa into a serial killer? Or do you think it was just people making their own decisions?
TriStar was shocked. I mean, Halloween and Friday the 13th and probably half a dozen other of these shows had been out by now, and they were absolutely shocked at the reaction. And it was, you know, look, typical big movie studio. They did not portray the storyline of the movie. They portrayed some particular action of a guy in a Santa suit. And I think that got everybody riled.
Okay. And one of the other things, too, that I'm sure had to add fuel to the fire was the whole big Siskel and Ebert fiasco. I had read about this, but I actually found the footage on YouTube of the segment where they talk about the show. Let me first off just tell you, as a fan of the movie, I mean, and as somebody that reviews films, obviously, I felt that they went extremely too far in trying to embarrass you and the producers and even TriStar. At the time when this came out, were you aware of it? And if you were, did you feel kind of, you know, like a slap in the face, or did you think they were just basically trying to use you and your film as like a martyr to further where they were as critics?
Well, here's what you have to remember. There's a backstory to this. I have, for most of my life, been a family filmmaker. Most of the films I've done are westerns, or they've been family animal shows or family shows. In that period, I'd say between 80 and 85, I deviated from that. Well, Siskel and Ebert had always hated my shows and hated the fact that they did well, and they always attacked every one of them. I'm talking about the four wall movies that we've been talking about. And so, you know, when Silent Night, Deadly Night came along, it was a main studio. It wasn't released by my company. It was released by TriStar. And it really gave them a chance to take, you know, some shots that they had always wanted to take, because in releasing in Four Wall, we went market to market. And so they would try to review one of our shows, but it might have been in Chicago, but it might not have been anywhere else. We circulated 50 prints, and we'd go market by market by market. It'd take us 2 or 3 years to play off the United States with a single show. So it had always been difficult for them to review us, because we weren't everywhere else. When they saw the show, they were only ones that had seen it, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so Silent Night, Deadly Night, I think, gave them a chance, the first show that we had done national all at once, to really review. And I must tell you that I have never, ever paid attention to the reviewers. The shows that I love, they seem to tank, you know, there are mixed reviews on the new Wolverine movie. I absolutely loved it, and I'm sure there's going to be mixed reviews or attacks on the new Star Trek movie, and I'll be one of the first in line tomorrow to see it. So I personally have never put much stock in reviewers. And so when when all this controversy came up and all this happened, I just assumed, like with our pictures, that it would help the growth, because it certainly did our shows.
Yeah, that's it certainly is the truth. And here's just an interesting stat I found about the opening day of the movie. I'm not sure if you're aware of this or not. I'd love to find out, though. Silent Night, Deadly Night, in its opening weekend, made about $1.4 million, which was actually $161,000 more than Nightmare on Elm Street, which opened up the same weekend.
Boy, I was just curious if, no.
It actually, I mean, Silent Night, Deadly Night actually played in more theaters, but it did outgross Nightmare on Elm Street, which leads me to this, just as, you know, a big what if maybe. Do you think if maybe the controversy, if it wasn't thrown out there and you know, created this huge thing about the film, do you think that the movie would have went on and grossed a lot of money and actually be, you know, put on a pedestal as a horror film, or do you think that it was better off the way
that
it worked out?
It worked out great. I mean, it is a cult classic to this day. There are more people that want to interview me every year about that movie than any other. I've made over 600 movies. I've written 128 screenplays, 19 books, and everyone wants to talk about that. So to this day, it's a cult classic. You know, Live Video contacted me sometime in the mid to late 80s and said, we want to do a sequel to Silent Night, Deadly Night. And what we want to do is we want to use the footage from the show, which they felt had never been really seen by anyone, mm-hmm. and we want to shoot some new footage around it. And by then, I was very, very busy. I was under contract to Universal. I was doing at the time a series of movies you guys may remember called Desperado. They were westerns based on the Henley song Desperado, mm-hmm. and they were all hugely successful. And I did two of those a year. For the next 3 years during that same period of time that Live got a hold of me. And I said, no, I absolutely won't be involved. And they went on, my understanding, you may be able to help me with this, to make three or four more of Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Yeah, they've actually, I think they're up to five now at this point. But
there were some things that happened on that show that I think we ought to talk about that knew could never, ever be duplicated again, which was one of the reasons I was busy, but I wasn't interested in trying to outdo myself in that first show. And, of course, I think you'll agree, they never have even come close to that first show in any of the other shows that they did. But I had some young filmmakers working with me on that show. Michael Spence, who was my second unit director, had worked with me since the 70s and went on to work with me for many more years after that. Rick Josephson, it was his first time as a lead special effects guy, and he was turned out to be massively creative with some great ideas that we were able to use in that show. I don't know how well you remember the show, but at one point this irate person picks up this gal who, if I remember correctly, it was Linnea Quigley, and hangs her on some antlers, elk antlers or antelope antlers or something that's in that cabin. And that whole scene was not in the script, and it came about because Rick Josephson came to me and he said, we've been doing some body castings of actors, and we think that we could do this in such a way that you'd do it in many cuts, Chuck, and you'd start out with the actor starting the lift, and of course then the stuntman finishing the lift, and then you go over to the antlers, and then we would cut in tighter the actress would be squirming and trying to get away, and we'd cut in tighter to this cast torso that we've made, and you'd see the antlers come through it. And that had never, ever been done before, something like that. And I thought, boy, this is a great idea. So then one of the things about this show is it was all shot at night, 35 days at night, which was just killer if you've ever been on a film crew. And it was all done in the snow and in the winter, which was a double whammy. So Henning Schiller was my DP and was my DP for many years until he passed away. He was in the process of lighting the cabin where we were going to do this. And he had put in what they call a work light so that we could all start rehearsal and everything. But he didn't have any old lights up and nothing was ready to go yet. And this work light happened to be low and cast the shadow of the antlers on the wall. And I grabbed Henning and I said, Henning, look at this. Those antlers on the wall. And so if you remember the show, not only do we have Rick Josephson's fine special effects work in there, but we've also got the middle part where she's being carried over and put on the antlers on the wall. You don't actually see it happening. It's just on the wall of the cabin. And that all, you know, sort of came about by accident. Michael Spence, the second unit director, he shot everything that didn't have an actor in it. So you really have two directors on that show. And I shot everything with the actors, and he shot everything. All the action stuff and all that was done by Mike. And what he would do is he'd come in behind me. I'd shoot the actors and be done with, say, the cabin, and then he'd take over and shoot the balance of the scene. And he was brilliant and did an outstanding job on that show as well. Now, in the show is an actor who plays the Santa, who's the hold-up artist, and it's Charlie Dierkamp, who I'd worked with in the 70s. And Charlie's a fun guy. He's fun to work with normally. He gets to play gangsters and things like that. But I put him in the role of this hold-up artist who is dressing like Santa. The very first night Charlie shows up on set, we were old buddies at the time, so didn't have to do any real get to know each other or anything. We set up for this first scene where he's alongside the highway and he's stopping this family and he's needing a ride. The scene is set up and lit, and Henning said, you know, Charlie knows what he's doing, and why don't we just go ahead and shoot the rehearsal? And I said, okay, fine. So we started rolling the cameras, always using two cameras for everything at least. And this car pulls up, and he goes over the window and starts talking. And I'm hearing something that I'm not understanding what's going on. And so I hollered, cut, cut. And I walked over to Charlie, and I said, Charlie, what's going on here? And he said, oh, he says, that's my Irish accent. And I said, what? And he said, yes, Chuck, don't you know Santa is Irish? And so I had to get Charlie aside, and we had to have a talk. And we got rid of the Irish accent, and then, you know, we shot the rest of the movie. So then Linnea Quigley, I don't know if you guys have ever heard this story, but Linnea Quigley was cast by the studio to be the gal that ended up being hung on the antlers. And so in the very first shot, we don't want the actor lifting her very far because it might hurt his back or something and hurt the rest of the show. So they start the lift. And so then I have to frame the camera lower because the stuntman is going to complete the lift and start to walk over. And so we lower the camera and we back up a little and he lifts, the stuntman lifts Linnea. And I go, cut, cut. And I call wardrobe, and I said, wardrobe. And the head wardrobe mistress came running onto set. I said, Linnea doesn't have any underwear on. And they said, yes, she doesn't own any. And so I had to get, at that time, there were no cell phones. I had to get on the company radio, and I radioed back to the office, and they got my wife, Julie, who fortunately is still married to me, on the phone. And I said, would you please bring over a variety of your underwear? I need them on set. So there was this little delay while she ran to set, and we got some underwear on Linnea and finished the scene. So that was another little thing that happened on that show that I can't think of something like that ever happening to me since or before.
I wanted to ask you a question about the actual story of Silent Night, Deadly Night. Since you said about the fact that you guys were trying to do some different things and things that were actually copied from the movie and used later on, it always struck me as odd that the movie was so controversial, especially after people had seen the movie, mainly because unlike a lot of slasher films, they just go into people straight killing. This movie actually sets up a backstory. It tries to give you an explanation, and in a sort of a way, tries to set up Billy as you know, a remote sympathetic character.
It justifies really why he did what he did, including, if you remember, the store that he worked at. The store owner said, you know, the regular Santa broke his arm or something and couldn't show. And he says, Billy, you're going to have to be Santa. And he says, and you know what Santa does. And yeah. Billy says, yeah, I know what Santa does. Well, what he knew Santa did was kill his family.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the thing was rich with story, the show was.
And something else I wanted to ask too, because I don't know if it just plays this way after time or if it was something that was intentional, but it seems like, and it's not the entire movie, but there seems like times during the movie, the scene with Grandpa comes to mind, and just some of even the antler scene with Linnea Quigley, it seems like the movie does have a rather strange and dark sense of humor. Was that something that was intended, or is that just basically the way that it worked out?
I think it was just the way that it worked out. Lillian Chavez, there was another big controversy from the Catholic Church. I don't know if you remember that or ever read about that,
mm-hmm.
but Lillian Chavez was a mother superior at this home that raised Billy, and she was a particularly negative character and didn't help. You know, Billy had come there after his family had been killed by this mm-hmm. hold-up Santa. And she further contributed to Billy not being like the rest of us, and leading him to being a slasher. And Lillian, the way she got to the set was, I was a big John Wayne fan, and Lillian had worked on North to Alaska. She was the guy that was supposed to marry his partner, and she ended up marrying this butler or somebody else. And I had always gotten a kick out of her. And when this agent called me and said, Lillian Chavin is available and would do this, I went, wow, that's great. And I think you'll agree, she did the most marvelous. See, here's the, when I say marvelous, what an actor needs to do is totally suspend any other thoughts you have and make you believe that they are that person.
Mm-hmm.
And Lillian made us believe that she was this horrible, wretched mother superior, to the point of where I would forget on set that it was the wonderful, sweet Lillian once we said cut.
Mm-hmm.
And so she just did a marvelous job of it.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask about her, too, because prior to working on the film, she had a very extensive career working in TV and in movies and everything else. Was she intimidating to work with, or even for some of the other actors, or was she really hands-on with people, and were people kind of taking a lot from her?
Oh, no, she was great. And always, when you get really good acting, it'll always raise the acting level of those around the one that's really, really good. I've seen that time after time. And conversely, if you get an actor, an actress assigned to you by the network or by the studio that is not a good actor, they can bring down the acting of those around. And Lillian was terrific to work with and very helpful to other people. Used a lot of local actors in that show, and she would help them get up for it.
One of the other questions I had, it seems, talking to you now, obviously, that you know, you're actually glad that you did the film, and it's obviously you've had a career after the film as well. Was there ever a point in your life where you thought you directing this film and being Yes. involved with this film was a mistake at all? Excuse me, I'm sorry.
I didn't hear that last question. You faded out on that.
Okay, I'm sorry. What I was going to ask was, obviously you've had a career after Silent Night, Deadly Night, and there was a lot of controversy dredged up at the time about the film. Was there ever a point in your life where you thought making the movie was a mistake?
Fangoria did an interview with me in about 1994 or the winter of 95 in that area. And they wanted to revisit the film, and I had become by then, and am today, a very faithful evangelical Christian. And I questioned in the Fangoria interview that I should have ever done that show. I probably should not have. But as filmmakers, we always do the best we can do and tell the story the best we can tell it. And we did in that show as well. Maybe too good. I am concerned. Films are less like this today, guys. They're becoming more mellow, and they don't even have bad words in them anymore. The latest shows I've seen this last year don't even have bad words in them. So they're becoming more mellow. But at that time, I worried that kids would see that movie and want to duplicate some of the things that were in it. In fact, I had a friend who did a horror movie, and one of the young girls in it was killed, and he was visited by a mother who had her daughter killed the same way, and it had just a massive effect on him. And I've always been concerned about that responsibility, and nothing's ever happened to come out of that. But that's just to answer what you probably have picked up over the years that I've been talking about, that I do have concerns that what we make can influence others. If it didn't, television spots wouldn't work, and no one would ever buy anything from a television spot. So we do affect people, and we do cause their behaviors to change, and that concerns me.
Okay. And one of the last questions that I have for you here, I've found some discrepancies, and I'm just curious to see if maybe you would know this. I know that when the film had come out on video years ago, it was released in a cut format. The movie was about 85 minutes long on VHS in America. The DVD that Anchor Bay put out a few years ago has an 88-minute or 85 minutes, I'm sorry. So that's the one that was released. But I found that there was a Belgium video release of the movie that's 96 minutes long. I just wanted to know if you were aware of this, and if so, is the DVD release that's out now considered by you to be your director's cut?
We did two versions. Back then, you always did two versions. You did an American version and a foreign version. Now, maybe I haven't done that in years, but back then we did. So what you're talking about is the foreign version, and it had some additional scenes which were judged to be too rough for America.
Okay. And this is absolutely my last question for you here. I'm sure you know, since you mentioned it earlier, about Silent Night, Deadly Night, having a lot of fans out there, and you get a lot of requests to talk about the movie through interviews. Have you ever been approached to do any horror conventions? And if not, would you consider doing them in the future?
I'm approached all the time about doing horror conventions. I was on location. There was one that was held in Los Angeles last fall, and I had to send Michael Spence, the second unit director, because I was on location filming and couldn't go. But, everybody all the time wants to it's sort of like a mini Star Trek, you know?
Yeah. Would you ever do one?
I never have done one. No, I haven't. I can get you sleep.
I think about the implications. Well, we're back. And I tell you, I had a great time talking to Chuck Cellier. I want to thank Ed for helping us out with the interview. I really, really want to thank Chuck for being so cool and talking to us and giving us some, you know, history and insight and things that he was doing. I tell you, Jason, we got to figure out a night, or you got to find a celebrity, because I need to get in on some more interviews with you. I had a blast doing them. But in the meantime, I guess we'll have to make do with my man Ed helping us out.
Well, I think Ed's a pretty nice substitute, so I don't think you have any problem working.
But he's not the animal.
He's not the animal, but he's definitely the Pittsburgh pimp, so that's for sure.
Oh, he's the big Pittsburgh pimp, huh?
That's what I'm
going to call him.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing about it is, Ed's a pretty big 42nd Street fan. He's big on the New York stuff. He's big on the 70s and the 60s, 70s, and 80s exploitation. So I think it just kind of goes, he's big into the old school porn. So I think it goes without saying that it should be Ed Pittsburgh Pimp Demko. I really do.
All right. Well, speaking of Ed, what we're going to do is we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, you're going to hear the Mom and Pop segment where Ed and I discuss the Silent Night, Deadly Night movies. Because, you know, we like to do themes around here. So we'll have Ed come back. We'll do the Silent Night, Deadly Night movies. And then after the Mom and Pop segment, you and I are going to talk a little bit about Fright Night.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So we'll be back right after this on the Gut Munchers podcast.
Every few minutes, a baby is born in America. And every few minutes, somebody dies. That's the cycle of life. The important thing is that the dead are supposed to stay dead. But somewhere, somehow, something has gone wrong. Scientists have been experimenting with a sonar device to make our food supply grow. But they've unleashed a terror beyond description. They've awakened the dead. Run home, lock your doors, bolt your attics, and seal off your basements. And whatever you do, don't open the window. They tampered with nature, and now we must pay the price. For those of you with a taste for zombies and the living dead, comes a nightmare tale that won't go away. Don't open the window. A special weekend late show from Filmways, rated R.
Well, hey, it's another installment of the Mom and Pop Video Shop. How you doing?
Absolutely wonderful. How you doing?
Oh, I'm pretty good, pretty good. I think I'm in the mood for something festive.
Which is perfect for the summertime, right?
Oh, yeah, you know, because nothing says summertime like Christmas.
Exactly. So what do you say? It's very fitting with this show, too. We talk a little bit about the Silent Night, Deadly Night series.
That sounds like a good idea to me.
Well, it's going to be a real bad idea once we get past the second film.
You mean past the first film?
Well, yeah, but you'll see. It gets worse. Believe it or not, it gets worse.
All right. Well, I guess we should start with the first film. Why don't you explain to me what I'm renting here?
All right. The original Silent Night, Deadly Night. Okay. It's a movie that is basically a slasher film, but it's a little bit different than your usual slasher film due to the fact that this one, like some of the great slasher films of all time, has been tied in with a holiday. Okay. And obviously this one being Christmas. Basically, the story of this movie, it starts out with a young kid named Billy and his parents on Christmas Eve go to see their grandfather in the old folks' home. And the old man basically doesn't talk, and he's a complete mute, except for when everybody leaves the room except for little Billy. He warns him that this is, you know, the most dangerous night of the year, and Santa Claus is a madman, which obviously isn't true in real life, but in this movie, that's the case. Basically, Billy and his parents run into a criminal on the side of the road dressed up like Santa Claus. They're terrorized by him, and we basically see how badly this affects Billy throughout his life, which, of course, reaches the boiling point in this movie whenever Billy's a teenager or, you know, about 18, 19 years old and has to play Santa Claus for the department store that he's working in. Or the toy store that he's working in. And obviously, you know, madness and mayhem ensues.
Yeah, see, I love this. I do love this movie because there's a couple of interesting things in it. First of all, excuse me. First of all, I love the randomness that you kind of mentioned where the grandfather just, like, flips out on the kid. And, mm-hmm. and you're, you know, I remember watching the movie and I'm like, what the hell's that? What's that about?
You know, it amazed me whenever we talked to Chuck Sellier that he really didn't play up the fact that this movie has like a completely black sense of humor. Mm-hmm. I mean, he acknowledged it a little bit, but I mean, that to me is what the genius of this movie is, because everything's played straight.
Yeah.
But it's really as jet black humor as you could possibly have. And that's one of the reasons why I love this movie so much.
Yeah. Just with the grandfather and then, now I gotta admit, the attack on his parents and him watching his mom with Santa Claus there on the road—that was kind of that's kind of not, I would say horrific, but I'm like, wow, they're not playing games with this.
Yeah, the movie definitely sets a tone, and it's funny too because, as you say, like I still remember the first time I saw this movie. Like, I thought the stuff with the grandfather was hilarious. You know what I mean? It's almost like in a, you know how in a lot of horror movies where the little kid sees something and he tells his parents and they're like, you're just imagining stuff.
Yeah, nobody believes him. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of that thing, but then it switches gears to, like you said, like that scene's pretty intense. And like it really sets the tone of the movie from that point on. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's a hell of a movie, man. It's really as far as the 80s slashers go. It's so much different than the other ones. But a lot of times when movies try and be so much different, they're not good at all. But this one succeeds on so many different levels. Because of, like, the humor, and there's some great gore scenes in it. You know, Linnea Quigley shows up, which is cool.
Early appearance of the twins.
Yes, the new twins, if you will.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, the movie just, it really, it's a blast to watch. I mean, I think that's something that a lot of horror fans get into as far as this movie goes. Because, you know, like I said, the humor is so jet black that if you're a horror fan, you're going to eat it up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because I've been watching a lot of slasher movies lately, and you know, the original Silent Night, Deadly Night does actually stack up really, really well versus a lot of the other things that I've been watching. You have some good nudity, you have an interesting killer, and I also like the character where he's not like it's a weird killer for one of these movies because, you know, he doesn't want to be Santa Claus. And I think that's part of the setup is he doesn't do the Santa. He's scared shitless of Santa Claus as a kid because Santa Claus kills people, you know. And it's funny because like the manager's like, you need to be Santa Claus. He's like, no. And he's like, no, you really need to be Santa Claus. You know what Santa Claus does? Yes, I do. I know how to act like Santa Claus. You need to act like Santa Claus. So he puts on the red suit and becomes a homicidal maniac.
Yeah, and I mean, it's funny too because this movie and its characters, just take away the characters in the movie. It's so weird how Billy is a sympathetic character. He never really does anything wrong in this movie, and his life is shitty. So obviously, you're set up to kind of feel some sympathy for him, and then when he goes on the rampage, it's still almost kind of the same thing. I mean, like, the people that he's killing are innocent people, but at the same time, there's reasons for it.
Yeah.
You know, like, he kills one of the guys that he works with, mainly because the guy's a jack-off. You know what I mean? It's a really, really weird story for a slasher film, because usually with slasher films, you have some sort of a revenge plot.
True.
And this movie does have that, but it's so fucking absurd that it gives the movie a really weird feel to it, and there's not a lot of slasher movies that are like that, or even horror movies like that, that kind of do that to you whenever you're watching them.
Yeah, and then I guess the one other thing that I thought was interesting, or that I think we need to make note of, is this actually has one of the most, ironically enough, I think it's fairly bloodless, but one of the most memorable kills in a slasher movie. I mean, I put this. Probably the only kill that I think is more iconic and people would instantly recognize whether they're horror fans or not would be the Kevin Bacon kill from the original Friday the 13th. But that's the Linnea Quigley kill.
Yeah,
that's kind of sticks with people.
Yeah, it's right up there with the best of them. You know, like whenever you talk with other great scenes in slasher movies, like the burning raft scene and like you said, the Friday the 13th scene with Kevin Bacon, or even the Friday the 13th scene towards the end with Betsy Palmer, the little fight with the beheading and everything. It's just one of the more memorable death scenes in a horror film. And I mean, let's be honest too, dude, Linnea Quigley has made her career on stuff like this. I'm a big fan of Linnea Quigley too. Yeah, and the twins. But you know, when you get the best of both worlds in there, you can't go wrong with it.
Yeah, dude. If I was a 20-some-year-old hot chick that would take my clothes off on camera, I'd have a career.
Yeah, and something. I'm sure you would. Yeah.
Of course, I'm trying to work out a career now where people will pay me to keep my clothes on, but it's not working out well for me yet.
Yeah, it's mainly probably the recession. I would assume it's hurting. Yeah, I blame the economy for everything.
Yeah, definitely.
Honestly. But yeah, man, I mean, the first Silent Night, Deadly Night's a really, really good horror movie. It's a blast. It's really cool. It's almost like a lot of people like me, for example, like I have great memories of this movie from the video store, too. Put it this way, if by chance you're listening to this and you don't know what Silent Night, Deadly Night is, type it into Google and do an image search on it. And I guarantee you, as soon as you see that box come up, you'll remember it from the video store.
You know what's funny, dude, is I never rented it.
Really?
It always kind of looked cheesy to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think I saw that until I was... I saw it on VHS eventually, but it was probably the mid-90s before I saw it.
Yeah, for me it was probably the early 90s, mid-90s too, and it was just due to the fact that, this always used to catch my attention. Like, when I was a kid, right, I was a big fan of the Friday the 13th movies, and I was always full aware of all the sequels that they had. But I remember you would see horror films in the video store, and then, like, as time passed, you would notice sequels. So, like, whenever I would notice stuff like that, that's generally something that would make me rent them. You know what I mean? Because then I'd rent all of them. So that's something that it sticks out in my mind. Well, I mean, this is one of the first sets of movies I remember that are like a franchise.
Clearly, no one would make sequels to shitty movies.
Yeah. I mean, come on. I mean, when you're 8 years old, 9 years old, that's basically what you think.
Are you depressing?
What's that?
When I said I didn't rent it to like the mid 90s, I'd have been like 25. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's face it too. That's another thing that everybody thinks about the mom and pop era, that there was like this ridiculous non-ending catalog of titles. I mean, yeah, you might have went to one video store, but like eventually you're going to rent everything. You know what I mean? So yeah. You would rent stuff multiple times. So, like, that's whenever there was, shitty sequels to something, it's like, well, I haven't seen this yet.
And you know what's funny is I really think some people think that, you go to the mom and pop video store and all these obscure movies that they're tracking down now were on the shelf. You had Sledgehammer and right next to Eyeball and right next to, all the sleepaway camps and right next to, you know, right next to all. It's like, no, not really. I mean, it was hit and miss. Some of them had some, and not everybody ordered all those horror films. Though there was a place here in town called Honeytown Video where I live that mm-hmm. did actually – the guy – he was a fan.
Mm-hmm.
It was like this guy was in his 50s, and he loved horror films. So that was the one section. It was huge. And he might have had just about damn near everything he could ever want.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, like, I remember there was a handful of video stores that I went to when I was a kid. And one of them, like, the biggest one that I went to is J&D Video. And you actually went in there with me. Whenever you came to Pittsburgh, remember we stopped into a store that had, like, VHS for sale, and there was, like, nothing in there?
Yeah, it was that, like, was used to run porn out of the back room.
Yeah, that was the place that I rented stuff from when I was a kid. It was completely different then, and it was a lot bigger, too. But they, the stuff that I really remember at the video store was the trauma stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all, obviously, like, the Silent Night, Deadly Night films and stuff like that. Not a ton of Italian stuff. You know what I mean? I remember Zombie and maybe a few things here and there. But not, like, you're crazy if you think you're going to walk into mom and pop shops and they're going to have, like, Umberto Lenzi Italian crime films. And, you know, I mean, some of them did, but it wasn't, you know, the norm, I guess, is the best way to put it.
It's funny because and we're kind of getting a little off the track, but I think it's important for somebody who, like, you know, I was like 12 when VHS players became big. And I watched the explosion of the small video stores. And I do love the mom-and-pop video stores. And I do love going in and looking at the horror section and looking at the VHSs. And there is some nostalgia for me. But mm-hmm. I also think people need to understand. And I don't know what they're like in Pittsburgh. But I'll tell you right now, if I walk into my local Blockbuster or my mm-hmm. local Hollywood video store, as much as we villainize them and say, yeah, 80 copies of the latest romantic comedy – if you look at their the movies that are on the shelves
mm-hmm.
that they actually put, they actually do have a much larger selection than mom and pop video shops did. Overall.
Yeah, overall, yeah. Overall, yeah. Well, mainly, too, because let's just look at it this way, too. They're square footage. You know, they're bigger. They're bigger
big,
places.
Big box stores, and they can afford to throw oddball titles on the shelves for a while.
You know, I actually remember, not to get too off track here, but I actually remember one time when I was younger going to a mom-and-pop shop with my uncle, and it was basically, from what I remember, it was in somebody's house.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It was shelving on walls. I mean, it looked like a store, but it was literally, like, in the basement of somebody's home.
There was a guy, I remember one of the earliest video stores I remember, the guy ran it out of his garage, and it opened when he got home from work at 6 o'clock.
Yeah. That's the way business used to be ran, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, it was a big deal because he had, like, two or three VCRs you could rent, and then he had just, you know, stacks and stacks of movies. And the guy's, like, basically, he's like, yeah, I run a business because then I get to order all the movies and watch them.
There you go. So, absolutely. But back to Silent Night, Deadly Night.
People making shitty sequels.
Yes. So I guess we should talk about part two.
It's garbage day!
That's appropriate because that's basically what the movie is. It's garbage.
Oh, yeah.
But I've always had a blast with this movie just because it's so, like, I mean, it's almost like a joke. You know, like, when people make a movie and you watch it, you're like, wait a minute here. Did somebody not realize that this thing is fucking terrible or what?
I think they did, dude, because, you know, I watched these two movies again. I took a bullet and watched Silent Night, Deadly Night 2 again, because I knew we were going to do the segment. And remember when they're in the theater and he's with that girl?
Yeah.
And it's like, he's like, what's the movie about? And she describes the plot, and it's like basically the plot to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, why would anybody watch that? Or something along those lines. I forget the exact,
yeah,
exact
it's,
quote. But basically, kind of like, what?
Yeah, it's really a movie that never needed to be made.
No.
It's,
it really wasn't.
I mean, the funny thing, yeah, it really wasn't, too. The thing that's funny about this entire series to me is I've never, like, once again, bringing it to Friday the 13th. Friday the 13th was never meant to be a movie to have a sequel.
No.
But I have to admit that in making sequels, they've really built an interesting story, okay? Now, with the Silent Night, Deadly Night films, that's not the case at all. When you watch the second movie, it's like the most forced sequel to anything ever that I could think of.
Yeah, they were reaching for it. Because, I mean, the first one did a pretty good job of, all right, we're done.
Yeah, but not this one. It really, it basically brings the series back from its grave, and probably shouldn't have. The one saving grace in this movie is some of the worst acting I've ever seen in anything by Eric Freeman, who plays Ricky in the movie, who in the series is Billy's little brother, which they barely touch on in the first movie at all. But it's pretty funny how they do it. He's getting interviewed in jail from a psychiatrist about all the stuff that happened, and then it basically leads to him moving on and doing stupid, crazy shit, but it's hilarious in the meanwhile. But it's only good to laugh at the movie and how bad it is, to be honest with you.
Yeah, because, I mean, I did find myself with points in this movie. I watched them back-to-back the first time, and I didn't make this mistake a second time, because I think people should know, God, dude, at least half this movie. Don't you think at least half the movie is footage from the first film?
Oh, absolutely, if not more.
So, I mean, when I say they barely made the movie, I don't know that they shot more than maybe 35 minutes worth of original material.
Yeah, it's absolute truth. It just really looks, unfortunately, like a bunch of incompetent people got together and just somehow pieced this movie. You know what I mean? Because it, like in the interview with Chuck Sellier, how he says that he was offered the movie and he just didn't want to do it again. It's almost like they expected him for sure to come back and do it, and the fact that he didn't, the project kind of fell apart.
Well, you know, and that's funny. I wonder what would have happened had he come back.
Well, I would probably guarantee you that it would have been a lot more of a movie as opposed to footage from the first film.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure that there would have been somebody in it that could act. Someone.
You know what would have been awesome?
What's that?
Zombie Santa.
Yeah. Yeah, I could deal with that. I mean, at this point, they're reaching anyway, so who gives a damn really what you're doing?
Well, dude, it's a movie. It's a movie about, well, I don't know, dude. It's not really about a killer Santa, because they make it very clear early on, the dude's not Santa Claus. But, I don't know.
Yeah, it's completely worth watching if you're into, like, mind-altering substances. But otherwise, you're probably going to feel like you broke your brain if you watch this movie.
Yeah, it's not very good.
No.
And people love it. It's one of those movies where people, it's so bad, it's good. I don't get that, because there's some movies that are really bad that I kind of enjoy watching. I would say this one's way more watchable than something like Troll 2, but...
Yeah, they're on the same level, though. It's funny how they get brought up in the same context a lot, but they're... I mean, it's literally, you have to find yourself being entertained and laughing at the lowest common denominator of crap. I mean, it's basically Silent Night, Deadly Night 2 is fun because Eric Freeman can't even read lines correctly.
Well, you know, dude, it's funny because I was just thinking about that to make the Troll 2 comparison. I think one of the reasons Troll 2 sticks with people is there's some lines in there that are so stupid that they just stick with you. And whether you like the movie or not, or how many times you've seen the movie, if you say to me, "Don't piss on his hospitality," I know what that's from. If
yeah.
you say to me, "It's garbage day," I know what that's from.
Yep.
Absolutely. Even though I think the movie's a piece of crap, it was so badly made, it sticks in my head. But I watched Silent Night, Deadly Night. I watched it for the show, but dude, I'll never watch that thing again. I hate that movie.
Yeah, it's not really something you're going to want to waste a lot of time on, basically. The only reason I own it is because I got the out-of-print Anchor Bay DVD that has 1 and 2 on it. Put it this way, whenever Anchor Bay did a re-release of Silent Night, Deadly Night,
yeah.
Okay, they didn't even put the second one back on it.
No.
So there you go. I mean, it wasn't even worth their time to do that.
And
it's
out of print already, too.
Is it?
Yeah.
I remember seeing that thing in Best Buys for a long time.
They printed a buttload of them, but it's already out of print. And in fact, I don't know if you saw the news, and it's a little off the topic again, but Anchor Bay's like just killing a ton of titles.
Wow.
Yeah.
No,
dude,
I didn't.
Yeah, do check the web out. But anyway, sorry. Sorry, guys. But, you know, again, we always warn you, we tend to wander.
Exactly. And it's very easy to do it considering the topic that we have going on right now, and we're in the middle of the sequels of the Silent Night, Deadly Night series.
So. Let's talk about Silent Night, Deadly Night 3, because I haven't seen that one.
Oh, man. Okay. Silent Night, Deadly Night 3 is also known as Silent Night, Deadly Night 3, Better Watch Out, which is very true, because you better watch out that you never accidentally see this fucking piece of shit movie.
So is it the Eric Freeman character again?
Okay. Here, let me try and explain this to you. Ricky, okay, his brother, is played in this movie by Bill Moseley. Everybody loves Bill Moseley, right? Yeah. Bill Moseley's awesome, not in this movie, okay? Now,
Ricky's dead.
Yes. Well, they thought that the Ricky character had died, but he's been brought back to life by a scientist. Okay? now wait
Holy
a minute.
Shit, dude.
Oh, no, wait. It gets better. A blind woman, okay, is somehow mentally connected to him and brings him back to life. Like, it has something in correlation to do with her, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, yeah, other than that, you get to see Robert Culp is in this movie. Okay, you know who Robert Culp is,
don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, he's in this movie. I couldn't tell you why. Apparently they offered him a lot of money or just something, but I don't know what the fuck would ever be appealing about this movie to anybody. And you get to watch Bill Moseley walk around with what looks like to be a fishbowl on his fucking head for the majority of the movie.
Why do they have a fishbowl on his head?
Because it's basically part of what the scientist was doing with his brain. Like, it's just a stupid special effect thing. You know what I mean? And now, okay, here's the thing. I was doing this earlier today because I knew we were talking about this. So I went on IMDb. I was just looking at the cast and some other shit about this movie. Now, I was reading a little bit on here about how this movie has connections with David Lynch. Okay?
Okay.
Now, I'm not going to go through and explain all this crap because, honestly, I don't believe anybody in the production process of this movie would ever be smart enough to try and do something like that. But the movie comes off as real, like, weird, artsy kind of crap at times, too, which makes it worse.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's nothing worse than a movie that has no point to begin with, but then for the person to think that they're artistic in the middle of it, on top of it. But you remember how I said earlier how the second one felt like such a reach to be a sequel?
Oh, yeah.
This one's like times 1,000, and it doesn't even remotely work. It's a miserable experience, and it's really bad to watch somebody like Bill Moseley because, I mean, dude, I love Bill Moseley. I love the shit that he does. And it's just kind of hard to sit there and watch him in this movie that does nothing but, like, waste your time. You know? And it's a piece of shit. So there you go.
And then how do they do part 4?
Okay, part 4 is interesting for a bunch of reasons, but you can tell from the beginning that this movie was never taken seriously, okay?
Okay.
This is the first sequel in the series to have nothing to do with the first 3. It's called Silent Night, Deadly Night 4 Initiation, okay?
Wait. Do they make masks, like, for Christmas, and there's druids?
You'd think so, okay. But no. Well, maybe. But anyway, the movie's directed by Brian Usna, who, if anybody knows anything about Brian Usna, knows his name from the connection with the Reanimator film and series, basically. But really what Brian Usna does is he takes over projects when directors don't want to do them.
Yeah, Stuart Gordon's like, I don't want to do any more Reanimators. I'll do them.
Exactly. And you know what? I think he did a good job with the Reanimator series, but this is not the case at all. And you will also notice Phantasm favorite Reggie Bannister showing up here. Okay? Now, if you haven't noticed something while you were listening to this, I'll explain it to you. Guys like Bill Moseley and Reggie Bannister are in a ton of shit because of the stuff that they've done. And this is the same thing. It's not anything interesting. This movie is so fucking complicated to explain, I'm not even going to bother. I mean, it's literally like there's the shit with this girl and all this other crap, and Clint Howard shows up, which, God forbid, I love Clint Howard too, but you know when he shows up that the movie is generally a piece of shit.
Oh, Oh, he's the ice cream man, buddy.
Exactly. That sums it up right there. But, I mean, this movie, it's kind of funny now because, you know, we have cliches with movies. Like, if it has 100, you know, stars in it from horror movies, that they're going to be in it for 12 seconds and yeah. It's going to suck and all
stunt
that.
Stunt casting.
Yeah, exactly. This movie has to be one of the first examples of that because it was from 1990. But when you listen to it now, it sounds like shit that comes out constantly. But it's funny because it's like, you know, Brian Yuzna's the director. Let's throw Reggie Bannister and Clint Howard in there, and people will check it out. But the funny thing is, if you look at the cover, there's not a sign of any of them. So whoever put that together is retarded.
Yeah.
The movie runs a little bit over 80 minutes, and it's pretty unbearable even getting to that point. So, as you can see at this point, from the classic cult film that the first one is, the series has completely fallen down the shitter at this point.
So, what the hell's the fourth one about?
Okay, I'm going to give this a try, right? Basically, the beginning of this movie deals with this lady who's a journalist, and her boss is played by Reggie Bannister. And they play up, like, the sexist angle where he likes all the dudes and hates the women that work there. Then a woman gets found dead on a sidewalk, and apparently she just combusts in midair. So this lady decides to seek out what happened to her. Then she goes to, like, I remember there's a thing with a butcher shop near where the fucking lady killed herself. You know, it's just bullshit with characters. Like, that's how they introduced Clint Howard, because he works in a bookstore that she goes to, like, you know, ask people stuff about. And, dude, okay, if you don't already have a headache from me explaining this to you, Ricky shows up in the movie, but I don't think it's the same Ricky, if that makes any sense.
No.
Yeah, it doesn't. They announce the character of Ricky. They act like he's supposed to be there, but then there's parts of the movie where, like, oh, man, I remember something where he's, like, pulling, like, these, like, worms or something out of this thing, like this pipe or something.
This doesn't sound very Christmassy at all.
No, I don't even – I mean, okay, wait a minute. Now, later on in the movie – they're like, it's Christmas time.
Okay.
That's the only thing, okay? Now, I'm looking right now. I'm not even going to lie because I don't remember the shit. I'm trying to find something out that reminds me of the movie. And I was just reading something, like, it says about they're reading this book that they got from this person at the bookstore. And it's called The Fire of Lilith. And it depicts a woman engulfed in flames. And then they do the fucking thing like in the movie with Lost Boys where there's a plate of spaghetti with worms on it and all the, I mean, dude, it's fucking literally we've went into the Candyman realm with this movie. Seriously.
Yikes.
And it's, I mean, if it doesn't sound like a fucking nightmare, I mean, they even, this even shows you something too that I remember too, and I'm reading it as, you know, as I'm talking about it. They actually reference the series because Ricky is flipping through a channel at some point in the movie, and there's a clip from Silent Night, Deadly Night 3. Yeah. So, it's a total nightmare. The movie is crap, and believe it or not, okay, it's even worse than 3.
That's saying a lot.
Yeah.
Because you said 3 is worse than 2.
Yes.
Then 2 is crap.
Oh, and it gets even weirder. And possibly worse. Because, okay, Silent Night, Deadly Night, Part 5 is called The Toymaker.
Okay, hold on a second, though.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make 3 sequels that couldn't possibly have made any money and keep crank out another one?
Because they were probably making money on video.
On video. Where it was indiscriminate and people just like, oh, well, I need something for the shelf.
And people like me who would rent the crap.
So it's your fault.
Yes, I'm partially to blame, believe it or not. But now, okay, check this out. Remember how the last movie I told you Clint Howard shows up and everything?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he's in this one again as Ricky.
He's Ricky?
Yes. Okay, but it has nothing to do, apparently, with the first film. Okay? Now, but there is a connection to the first film. Bear with me. Okay? There was an actor during the time of the first one who had a protest letter out against the film, stating that the scum who made it should be run out of town for having sullied the sacredness of Christmas. Okay? That actor was legendary Hollywood actor Mickey Rooney. Mickey Rooney is in this movie.
Cool.
What the fuck? I mean, and this one also was written by Brian Yuzna, or co-written by Brian Yuzna. And I'll be honest with you, I don't remember this one all that well. I just remember that the point of this movie is there's a guy who makes toys, and the toys are killing people. So whoever made this movie, I'm assuming since Brian Yuzna wrote it, he had something to do with, obviously, the movie being made, that he picked up on the full moon shit at the time.
Well, and Yuzna was working with Charles Band, or he had worked with Charles Band in the past.
Yes, and there you go. So basically, if you ever wanted to see a Charles Band doll movie with Mickey Rooney that apparently has something to do with the Silent Night, Deadly Night series, watch this movie. But if you want my advice,
it's probably not as bad as the other ones.
Oh, it is.
Is it?
Yeah. It's just, see, it's more of the same. And this one, although I'll admit this, 3 and 4 are not funny. They're not entertaining. There's nothing to them. Okay. Mm-hmm. 5, on the other hand, you can enjoy it on the same level as 2. Due to the fact that it's so stupid and so bad and so over the top, just retarded, then maybe you'll find some funniness in it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
But at the same time, have you ever noticed how you haven't seen 3, 4, or 5 on DVD?
Yeah.
There's a good reason for it. They're terrible films.
Oh, there you go. You would think at some point they'll get a box set, though.
You would think so, but apparently nobody has thought it to be even remotely important enough to do.
Well, Ed, this is when we need to start our DVD company, putting out the shit that shouldn't be put out on DVD.
Exactly, and charge $70 a disc for them.
Yep. We'll put these out. We'll put out Martin. We'll put out...
God damn you. You're lucky I couldn't think anything right there, you son of a bitch.
Damn. I always have to throw that at you.
We'll put out Santa's Sleigh.
Santa's Sleigh is a good movie starring, ironically enough, Robert Culp.
Oh, thank God.
Robert Culp's in that movie. You didn't know that, did you?
I knew that.
And of course, you have horror icon, Chris Kattan. That's where you thought I was going to go the first time, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, and I'm even more disappointed that I fell into the further trap.
It does have Robert Culp in it, though.
Yeah, he's in it, and it surprisingly well. Hey, you know if, and I thought Silent Night, Deadly Night 3 was the worst movie he was in.
No, probably not by far.
Well, you know, Santa's Sleigh is pretty bad too, but
Sleigh's awesome, dude.
Oh, that movie's terrible.
It's got a ball.
And I like wrestling, and I can't even watch Goldberg killing people. It's not even fun to me.
Oh, you got to admit, the first few minutes of that movie where Goldberg wakes the family out is cool.
Well, that's cool, and then it all had me interested, and then the whole thing, it reminded me of Ghost Ship. It's like, please don't blow. Like, there's a reason whenever people watch porno that the money shot's not the first thing that happens.
Well, yeah. Ghost Ship, you're right, though, is that scene with everybody getting cut in half still creeps me the fuck out.
And it's a
the
great
rest of the
scene.
A piece of shit. And they're like, wait, what?
It'd be like
opening Dawn of the Dead with the mall thing. And then spending the next 2 hours having them talk and then take off in a helicopter.
But see, maybe we're taking this the wrong way. Okay? Maybe the people who made Ghost Ship are just very compassionate to working people. Because they give you the best part of the movie, and then you could just fall asleep. You don't have to worry about watching anything or finding out why anything happens. You could just go to bed and go to work the next day.
I guess, yeah.
But But that is the Silent Night, Deadly Night series. If you are unlucky enough to have missed the first one or seen any of the other four ones, I hope to help you guys out, and maybe you'll be smart and avoid them.
Yeah, my opinion is check out the first movie.
Yep.
I think it went out of print again. Even if it's not, though, I think Anchor Bay is about to drop a lot of their titles. And I would recommend people go out and get this movie while they can. As far as the other four, they're oddities. If you can get them, if you're at a flea market and you see the VHS for $1, yeah, go ahead and pick it up.
Yeah, I'm just going to tell you to save your dollar. Burn it. Do whatever you want with it. Just don't spend your money on these fucking things. Maybe steal them when the people aren't looking.
I don't know. It might be worth checking out once. As bad as you said they are, now I have to see 3, 4, and 5.
Well, see, I was going to say 2 is worth checking out for cheap. 5 is probably worth checking out for cheap. 3 and 4, you will want the time back in your life, believe me.
Yeah, I know, but I watch a lot of crap movies, so what are you going to do? But anyway, my recommendation is do go get the first one. I highly recommend it, and the rest of them, I really don't spend any money on them.
Exactly. I would definitely hold off and, maybe watch them at a friend's house. Hey, if you know people like me and John, there's a good chance we will have these movies. So we're sick and twisted, so you don't have to be.
Yep. Then we've probably spent money on them somewhere, so...
So it's even worse.
Yeah.
Oh, yep. Man.
Well, hey, thanks for stopping by.
Hey, you thanks for stopping by. That's this is right. My shop, damn it. Thank you.
Yeah, where's the rent, bitch?
No, fuck that. Hey, you owe me back rental charges, and you're never kind, and you don't rewind.
Yeah, your porn selection sucks. It's all porn.
And I keep having, people complaining about all the Chris Kattan titles go fuzzy every time he's on screen.
Yeah.
What's that about?
I don't know, man.
You're the only one that rents them here.
Chris Kattan's awesome, dude.
Oh, man.
Mango.
Well, Mango's funny, but
yeah,
still.
Mango's funny.
But yeah, thanks for stopping in.
Romano, that's a classic.
Not in this place, it's not, damn it.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for stopping by. See you next time.
Yeah.
And be kind. Pay your bill.
Yeah, well, I might rewind, though.
Okay.
Of course, I'm renting DVDs, so.
Make sure you rewind those.
Oh, yeah. I will. I'm in a rewinding machine. That's what sucks about DVDs. I wish there was like a DVD cleaner that looked like a Corvette. Remember the old cool VHS
yeah.
That was like partier. It's like you'd have the giant like console size 350-pound top loading VCR next to it. You'd have like this big honking 1957 Chevy plastic looking thing. You'd be like, this is how I rewind my videos, so as to protect the heads of my tape player. And it'd like, sound like a car driving down the road. Yeah, that was
and it's,
back in the day.
And it's like, plus, whenever I'm not rewinding anything, it looks kind of snazzy on my shelf.
Yeah, it's my, it's in my rec room here in my study. Yeah. Got that, and I got, and then I got my Budweiser, neon light thing hanging on the wall, and, oh, yeah.
It's right next to my statue of Spuds McKenzie.
Yeah. Or in your case, it'd be like, yeah, it's right next to my collection of Iron City beer cans from the 1970s Steelers dynasty.
That still have beer in them, I think.
I swear to fucking God, dude, every house I go in when I'm out in Pittsburgh, I go into the basements, and we're completely, but I don't care. Yeah, guys, you can fast forward if you want to hear this shit. I don't care. But every goddamn house I go into Pittsburgh has at least one old crusty can of Iron City beer in the basement somewhere.
Yeah, I was going to say, we don't have any, but we did.
Yeah, well.
We certainly did.
That's true, but you have an autographed picture of Franco Harris hanging on your wall.
No.
Who's the autographed picture? Mean Joe.
Mean Joe Green.
Mean Joe Green, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's a guy
but that's cool.
Franco
See,
Harris.
Maybe we'll be able to have some new Iron City cans after the Penguins win the Stanley Cup, though, because they're going to.
Game 7 in Detroit.
Game 7 in Detroit, yes, taking the cup back to Pittsburgh, brother.
I promise not to wear my Red Wings jersey for at least a month.
Huh.
All right, well, that's been another exciting segment of the John and Ed Sports Talk.
Yeah, thanks. You could call in the Sports Talk line at 555 Yeah.
Yeah, and we can talk about which player the Pirates are going to trade next.
They're just going to trade their stadium for players at this point.
Yeah. Well, it's nice because I think, you know, my Red Sox need a few more players, even though they're beating the crap out of the Yankees, but, you know.
Well, see, just when people think we go off topic, we bring back the horror and talk about the Pittsburgh Pirates.
There you go.
It's awesome. So, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. All right.
I'm gonna go cry myself to sleep now.
Ah, don't cry yourself to sleep. Be a man. The Steelers won the Super Bowl. That's all that matters.
Well, I'd need multiple championships in 1 year, goddammit.
Yes,
well. There ain't nothing else going on in this city.
Doesn't Pittsburgh have a field hockey team or something?
I don't know. I'm too busy looking for VHS tapes at flea markets.
Yeah, that's a good plan.
Not really, but thanks, right. Guys.
Bye.
When was the last time a movie froze you to your seat, made your palms sweat, quickened your pulse? Cat o' Nine Tails really does the job. National General Pictures presents Cat o' Nine Tails, from the same masters of tension who paralyzed audiences with Bird with the Crystal Plumage, the picture that outpsychoed Psycho. Cat o' Nine Tails, starring Carl Malden, James Franciscus, and Catherine Spock. It's nine times more suspenseful than Bird with the Crystal Plumage. Cat o' Nine Tails. Rated GP. All ages parental guidance.
We're going to talk about the first of the two movies that Jason and I are going to review for this month's episode. We're talking Fright Night. Classic movie. I love this film. Basically, you have a guy named Brewster who's got a really hot girlfriend who would later go on Married with Children and then later come out as a not liking boys, but that's okay because she's still really hot in this movie. But Brewster has this really good-looking girlfriend and kind of a nerdy guy that he likes to call Evil. Evil Ed, I think it was. Wasn't it Evil Ed? I think it's Evil Ed.
Yeah.
One night he's, you know, trying to make some time with his lady friend when he sees that the neighbors are moving in, or some people moving in across the street, and they're carrying some strange things into the house. And Brewster's kind of a nosy, so he keeps hanging out. And eventually he sees that his neighbor, the suave and good-looking neighbor, is in fact a vampire. And these women's bodies start to turn up all over town. And only Brewster knows that it's his neighbor, the vampire. The problem, though, is that the neighbor finds out, the neighbor very quickly figures out that Brewster knows, and he's going to kill Brewster. So what are you going to do? If you're in a situation like that, what are you going to do? Well, of course, he likes to watch old movies. And their local midnight horror host is the great Vampire Slayer. Dude, I just forgot Roddy McDowell's character's name.
Peter Vincent.
Peter Vincent. Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. Peter Vincent, the Vampire Slayer. So basically, the rest of the movie, if you haven't seen it, I don't know about you, Jason, but I would be shocked if people had not seen this movie by now. But if you haven't seen Fright Night, the rest of the film is Charlie and Peter trying to go and get, or trying to slay the vampire, which is further complicated because he grabs his girlfriend, Amy, who is Charlie's girlfriend, and he also turns Evil Ed into a vampire, which leads to one of the best lines. We'll talk about that later on, one of the most memorable lines. So then they have to go do battle with Chris Sarandon. That's the actor's name, but basically the vampire. And his, I guess, I don't know, you call him ghoul or whatever. He's not a vampire, but there's something about him that ain't right, because you keep shooting him and he doesn't die. But anyway, so it's basically your typical vampire movie, except for the fact that it's uber, uber cool, and I get a major kick out of it. So that's Fright Night in a nutshell. for me anyway.
Well, I think you did a good job with that explanation for sure. For me personally, I remember watching this right when it hit VHS. I think it came out in 85. And so I probably saw it when it hit VHS that same year, 86 or something like that. And my dad bought it for me for Christmas.
Weren't you really young?
Yeah, I was probably in 85, 86. I was probably like 8 or 9.
See, that's and funny.
My dad was the coolest dad in the world. He was like, sure, I'll get that for you, because I saw, like, of course, I probably saw, like, a TV spot for it or a trailer on the TV. And I was like, oh, and I was like, I'm like a huge vampire fan, growing up as a kid. So I was like, Dad, can I have that movie? And he was like, oh, he always would say, that movie's too old for you, Jason. You can't watch that movie. And then sure enough, he'd show up with it sometime down the road. That's just how he was. And so for Christmas, I received a Fright Night.
Cool.
And so my first introduction to that movie was, as like an 8 or 9 year old kid. And I loved it. I thought it was so cool. I thought everything about it, of course, when I was a kid, I was like, boobies, because there's you see some booby action when, so when you're like
like
a little
anymore.
Well, not necessarily. I don't purposely go out looking for boobies in movies. I've grown a little past that. So
I've not grown past that. I like the boobies.
that's not a prerequisite now that I need to have in my movie. I don't have to have that in a film. But the cool thing about the movie is that Tom Holland harkens back to an older, more sophisticated time with his movie. He uses lots of, winks and nods to, like, the 1930s and 40s movies. And everything from some of the music, not the actual soundtrack, which is very 80s, but some of the music to the locations. I think those, like, he was used probably a back lot because all the houses look like it's the same as the ones they were using in the Monster Squad, actually. And they had all, like, this real kind of, like, gothic look. You have that. And then you have, of course, Peter Vincent, which is a play on Peter Cushing and Vincent Price, the Roddy McDowell character. Then, of course, he had, like, the Roddy McDowell's character plays an old-timey, horror host. And so I just think a lot of, Tom Holland also, he didn't really get an excessive gore. It was more like genuine scares and creepy feelings than like, blood all over the place.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think that for me, that's the reason why it still holds up today. I think the special effects still hold up today. And so that's a little bit of my personal viewpoints of, first coming into it and kind of what I feel about it. What say you, Mr. John?
Yeah, dude, actually, the Fright Night thing, I'm kind of surprised you saw it as such a young kid, because I remember being completely freaked out by the vampire version of Amy. She freaked me out, but with the giant, it just really horrific, like, that was some messed up, crazy stuff. But it is pretty good. I mean, I love it. It's a great movie, and it's got some classic lines, like, when Evil Ed has the note, and he's like, "She says his supper is in the oven." That's a terrible impersonation. But you know what I'm saying? And I love that friggin' line. That's awesome.
Oh, I agree. I love that. Yeah, when he's dressed like his mom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
And then the Peter Vincent character, Roddy McDowell's just awesome. Roddy McDowell's just was, Planet of the Apes, this movie, I mean, so many other movies, Legend of Hell House. Roddy McDowell just was an incredible, incredible actor.
And you can't forget he also was in Crazy Larry, Dirty Mary.
Oh, yeah, he also did a blaxploitation movie. I can't remember the title, too, but he showed up in a lot of weird things in the 70s, but it was pretty cool. I really enjoyed it. I don't know. I don't know if I have much more to say about it. I do really enjoy the movie. I think the movie's great. Classic from the 80s. Tom Holland's a great director. And it's just one of those movies that I just really get a kick out of. I really have fun with. And I think pretty much everybody else should have fun with it, too.
Totally. And I was just going to say also that the scene you're talking about when Amy turns around full vampire, you know, I've mentioned this 100 times probably because I've been championing this movie since I've got on the internet, you know, back 10 years ago, whatever. But, I mean, I absolutely loved that scene. But when I was a kid, that seriously scared the piss out of me. I mean, when I saw that, I was, like, seriously freaked out. I mean, like, again, I was, like, 8 or 9, whatever.
Dude, I was, and I was probably 16.
I was terrified.
I was 16, and I was like, whoa! And I mean, even now, the last time I watched it, it didn't freak me out. Because, you know, I know it's coming, and I'm much older. But, you know, I'm sitting there, and I'm like, you know, wow, this thing still gets me as an adult. This thing still gets me as an older adult. So, right. I don't know, man. It's a great. I guess the only real thing I have to say about this movie that's at all negative,
right,
is how is it that you have an iconic movie like this with lines that people quote, and I don't even think it's a genre movie. I don't think it's obscure at all. I think Fright Night's a pretty big deal. A lot of people know about it. You have Roddy McDowall. You have Chris Sarandon. How does this movie not have a better DVD release?
What did you say? Yeah, what did you say about that? Not a good release?
Yeah, how does it not have a good DVD release?
Oh, I know. It's ridiculous.
I mean, mine is, it's just a regular bare-bones DVD, no special features. It's got the option of widescreen or full screen. So it's like one of the old DVDs, like when it first came out. It's a dual-side flip one. And I don't think there's a better version than that out.
No, the one I have is, I think it's a widescreen, and it has like 15 options of different languages, which is retarded, and that's all it is, and then, you know, I think there's like a trailer, and that's it, so I definitely agree that it should, you know, needs to get a proper release, because I know a lot of people are saying this year is like the year that so many people, or so many DVDs are coming out on DVD for the first time, so many movies are coming out on DVD for the first time, and that's great, and I'm great, and maybe we can do a show talking about that sometime or whatever, but I think Fright Night for sure is definitely a movie that deserves a proper release with all the special features. So hopefully we'll get that sometime down the road.
Yeah, hopefully. I don't know, man. Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, it's odd what's out. It's odd what's out. Sorry again there, Jason. But
it's okay.
It's odd what's out and what's not out. I mean, it's just one of those things where it's just kind of crazy what you have. But yeah, it's just, I don't know. You know, Fright Night's a good movie. I like it. I know everybody likes it. And it's just one of those things where you just, you kind of wonder what the heck is going on. I don't know. It's one of those, I love this movie, but I don't know that I have much more to say about it other than the fact that I love the movie and it's cool.
Yeah. And I mean, the two things, again, that you mentioned, one thing you mentioned was the quotes. The movie has an infinite amount of quotes. I mean, you can go from everything as, "You're so cool, Brewster."
Oh, that's another great line.
Yeah. "Welcome to Fright Night for real." Mm-hmm. You know, "I am Peter Vincent, the vampire killer." I mean, you know, it goes on and on and on. There's all different kinds of ones. And like the one you talked about, you know, about the food. And, you know, but, you know, you can't go wrong. The movie has great quotes. It's definitely 80s. The soundtrack's an 80s soundtrack done by the Jay
Gals. I think did the theme song.
Who did?
Jay Gals, man.
Yeah, that's what I was just saying. Yeah, yeah. You know, and they have a lot. And the movie, this is so good. The special effects hold up even today. And I think, you know, now I honestly have to be honest when I say that. Chris Sarandon, though, a lot of people don't like him as a person, which I have my own viewpoints about Chris Sarandon. But him in this role, he's awesome. He's probably one of the best vampires I've ever seen, like modern day vampires. And he plays it not hokey at all. He plays it straight. And I really enjoyed it. So, yeah, I can't give this movie any higher recommendation.
Yep, I agree. And I do really, really recommend it. It's probably one of the best vampire movies out there. So.
Yes. Do yourself a favor and watch it.
Yes. Yes, do yourself a favor and watch it. So, all right. Well, I you know, I guess that's it for Fright Night. And we can go ahead and take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Killer Clowns from Outer Space. What do you think?
I'm ready.
Okay.
All right.
All right. But we'll be right back on the Gut Munchers Podcast.
An almost true story of girls who knew the way to a man's heart was not through his stomach.
It's the Little Whorehouse on the Prairie.
They were just fun-loving country gals who offered us hard-working good old boys a place to come at the end of the day.
Little Whorehouse on the Prairie.
It's got jiggles and wiggles you'll never see on TV.
Plus, how to pick up girls of the Haystack Hookers, a sex-citing triple thrill show, all rated R.
Hey fans, it's Ken Foray. Just want to tell you about Mail Order Zombie. Great company. They review zombie films, any zombie film, every zombie film. And it's something you should tune into. So if you get a chance, go to the website, look these guys up, Mail Order Zombie, and find out what the hot zombie films are today. What's going on? These guys are right on the cutting edge of reviewing zombie movies. And if you're a zombie, or you want to be a zombie, or you're thinking about being a zombie, or your mom's a zombie, your dad's a zombie, or your damn mother-in-law's a zombie, tune into Mail Order Zombie, baby. You'll find out what's going on. Ken Foray, and that's out.
And we're back. Now we're going to talk about the second movie that Jason and I are going to review for this month's show. And that is Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to let you explain to the fans, both of them, about Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Yes, no problem. Killer Clowns from Outer Space is an alien invasion movie. As the title suggests, they are killer clowns and they are from outer space. And they land in this small town and dress as clowns. And they have these clown type of weaponry. And they go around and starting to kill the townspeople. And, of course, nobody really takes them serious at first. And there's all these people calling into the police station saying, you know, there's these evil clowns with their, like, popcorn guns and cotton candy machines turning people into, like, you know, cotton candy, like, juice bars and all this stuff. And the police and most of the townspeople don't believe them, except for a very few small group of young people who realize that everybody's in danger and finally convinces the local, like, town sheriff or whatever to be on their side and realize what's going on. So they get him armed with their other buddy's ice cream truck and go and save the girl Debbie from a killer clown invasion that they were being attacked by. So that's kind of it, I guess, in a nutshell. It's as far as that, you have some very interesting special effects with this movie, I think, which is great. And so that's it. I guess I'll leave it at that. There's my son. So you have your dog and I have my son. So there you go.
And, you know, we're a professional outfit here. So
I know. Only people who are professional on here is Steve and Ed because they don't have any, like, extended family showing up in their segments.
Exactly. Well, I have – before I talk a little bit about the show – about the movie, I have an interesting story about Killer Clowns from Outer Space. And I've said this a couple other places, but I'm going to tell my story again. When I was in college when this movie first came out. This movie had a very, very limited theatrical release. But it was Thursday night, and it was like, the movies change on Friday morning, so it's Thursday night. And I just finished up some college work. And I realized if I really, really, really broke the speed limit, I could drive out to this. It wasn't even my local theater. It was a theater, I think it was about 35 miles away. I could just make it in time for the late showing, late night showing on Thursday night of Killer Clowns. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to do it. And I hopped in my car, and I drove out there, and I got there, and I had like 5 minutes before the movie started, so it was great. Went in, bought a ticket. I should have known something was up, because when I bought the ticket, the girl looked at me kind of funny. But I gave her my money. I bought the ticket. I went in. I bought a glass of pop or a cup of pop. Went in, sat down, waited for the movie to start, right? And all of a sudden, I hear the door open, and these two people lean in, and they're looking at me. And I'm sitting in the theater all alone, but it's a Thursday night. It's a late night showing. And I'm kind of like, wow, why are these people looking at me funny? And, you know, a couple minutes later, this guy comes in, and it's the manager. And he's like, excuse me, sir, I had to see. And I'm like, huh? And he's like, as long as I've worked here, we've never had a movie not sell a ticket. And what had happened is this movie had opened that Friday and had gone from Friday to the last showing on Thursday without selling a ticket. And the only ticket they sold was for that last show Thursday night, and it was to me because I was in the theater all by myself. So, I mean, he got some free popcorn and stuff and candy, and he gave it to me because he's like, I just had to see who was coming to see this movie. He's like, I had to see who was going to – who, because he's like, we thought – we were all sitting there going, okay, it's 5 minutes before the show. We're actually going to have a movie that we didn't sell a single ticket for. And I was the ticket they sold. So I have a great story, and I got to see Killer Clowns from Outer Space on 35mm on the big screen.
That's awesome, dude. That's a killer story, man. That's so cool. Yeah.
But, you know, so even back in the day, I was a horror fan, see? So – now that was my Killer Clown story, which I've told several occasions. I always take every opportunity to talk about it.
I never even heard that story, so that's awesome, dude.
It's funny actually. I told it on Deadpit once in a call-in, basically, that's my Killer Clown story. The movie, you know, I think the special effects are kind of cool and interesting. They do a lot of silly things. First of all, the clowns look awesome.
Yes,
clown makeup is great. I love it. They look creepy. They look alien. They got the big mouth, the teeth. Scary, scary shit. Seriously, scary shit. No doubt. Some of the things they do with, like, the cotton candy guns and that, those are all fun. I will say there are the two effects that I always kind of cringe because I think they did them old school by scratching the film. They look really, really primitive. Is when they shoot somebody with a cotton candy thing. And you get the sparks of light, and they spin. That looks a little silly. It actually looks like not very good. Not just silly, but it just, that effect doesn't look very good. And when you kill the clowns, see the clowns are pretty much impervious. These aliens are impervious to damage, unless you hit them in their big red noses.
Right.
If you destroy the nose, the clowns die, and they do just the like same thing in this weird green effect. I do actually. I love the clowns. I love that they gave them all. The clowns all have an individual, unique look. They did a really great job making them all kind of like different characters. Some of the ways the clowns capture and kill people, like with the shadow puppets or the puppet show. They have the ray guns. They have all kinds of crap. But it really is pretty badass. And it's just such a weird movie, too, that, you know, even from the moment I saw it, I was like, wow, these guys were on something. But it works. It just works because after a while, you're kind of like, wow, it's aliens that look like clowns. Okay, that's as likely for an alien to look like as anything else, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the big top, the spaceship being a big top, their base being in a fun house, it just... As a movie, I just really dig it. I thought the whole thing was just killer.
I can't agree with you more. You know, my situation was I don't have a cool story like yours, but I started watching it probably on either HBO or Showtime in the 80s when it first came out. I think it came out in 88. And so not too long after that, whenever HBO started playing it, or again, like Showtime, Cinemax, like whatever.
Its theatrical release, I think, lasted a week.
Right. So, yeah, exactly. So it was probably sometime in the late 80s when I finally first got around to seeing it. You know, me and my friends would gather around the TV and my brother, and we would just watch the movie whenever it came out. Because it's one of those movies when you're a kid, again, where it's scary, but it's so goofy that you're not really terrified. Like, where Fright Night was opposite. Like, you know, that would really scare the hell out of you if you're a little kid. And, you know, well, Killer Clowns is definitely has scary moments in it, or, you know, but it's so done, it's such done in a tongue-in-cheek manner that you don't get so freaked out and whatever as a child. But, you know, I agree, all the stuff, the special effects I thought were great. I thought they spent most of the money probably was definitely on the clown and the clown effects, which I thought, even still today, for the most part, still hold up really well. I thought the acting was really good. I thought John Vernon was really great in it as Curtis Mooney.
Dano's good too. Roy Dano's awesome.
Yeah, Roy Dano. Yeah, really good. I think who was he? The
what did
farmer?
You do with my dog Pooh? Where's Pooh Bear?
Pooh Bear. So
know,
I mean,
people haven't seen this.
Those
movie
guys turned into performances. About. Yeah. So I mean, you know, I thought the movie was good. I loved it. Like I said, growing up, watched it with my friends and family. We get together and watch. Like I said, and the scene that stuck out in my mind, at least, as really being creepy and like something that always still kind of gives me like an uneasy feeling is when the clown has his hand in the back of John Vernon's head and uses him like a ventriloquist dummy. And John Vernon, you know, has like a real like blushed and, you know, flushed cheeks and, you know, has kind of like that ventriloquist dummy look. And it really, when I was a kid, man, it scared me. It had that good creepy scare in it. So, you know, and like I said, it's just so out there. I mean, I've no idea. There's nothing been before or after this movie that's quite like Killer Clowns from Outer Space. It's its own entity.
It is. It's very wacky. And if you think about it, it seems like a very silly, funny movie, but they're like killing people right and left. And it's like a horrific ways, too, because they're actually killing them and then turning them into food.
Oh, yeah. I like how they stick gigantic straws in those, you know, candy balls, and like sucking out their like blood. Ugh.
The cotton, just to let everybody know what happens is they shoot with these cotton candy things, these guns that wraps you in cotton candy, and then they hang you on these poles, and you never really see what's going on except for the fact that somehow you're being digested and turned into food.
Right.
So it is really a pretty badass movie in that way. It's very cool. I love that. And it's, you know, and there's a lot of crap going on that's pretty, I don't know, I would say horrific, but, you know, it's not like a silly movie in any manner whatsoever. You shouldn't consider it to be silly or goofy, even though it does kind of have a goofy feel to it. It's this weird combination for me. You know what it reminds me a lot of is a lot of the movies I watched when I was growing up that were from the 50s. It does have a very, it's like one of those old school alien invasion movies that also happens to have a really, really freaking silly concept to, which is the fact they're clowns. You know, and it just, it's, I don't know. I really, really like this thing. The giant clown, that effect is done pretty well.
Yeah, like Clownzilla.
Clownzilla, yeah, that's done real well.
Oh, yeah, it's done. I mean, like I said, I'm telling you, I mean, I know you mentioned a couple things that didn't hold up as well, you know, looking at it now, but I mean, as a whole, for the budget they had and for, you know, for the stuff that they did, I think it looks great. And, you know, the thing that really says to me, like, with both this and Fright Night is, you know, those budgets weren't as big as they are nowadays, and the money wasn't probably, you know, money, of course, with Fright Night, the money's probably spent a lot on actors because, you know, they got some decent names at that point. But the special effects still look good today, and they still hold up today. But you have movies coming out, like, you know, right now, that have terrible special effects and this terrible CGI and all this stuff. And, you know, they don't even hold up now. So, you know, in 10, 20 years from now, they're going to look like this stupid. This is going to look like video games or something. And so I just really think that goes back to saying that the creators of these films, the special effects creators, the directors, everybody involved, really put their money where their mouth was and really put together a good quality film and, you know, really spent the time doing good effects for the films.
Yeah, again, I mean, you know, here we are 21 years later, and like you said, the effects do hold up. The clown effects hold up. And I don't know. Oh, you know, one of the other things I love, and it doesn't look great, but it's still kind of okay effects-wise, but I just thought it was a really neat idea, is the clown that's, like, racing, like he's not in a car, but he's, like,
pretending
to be in a car.
Mm-hmm.
That is probably my second favorite chase scene in a horror film, next to the one in Leprechaun.
That is awesome. I forgot all about that.
But it is actually a very I don't know, a very cool movie. I liked it a lot.
And one, you mentioned one of your quotes, and I was going to tell you one of my quotes I love for the movie is when Curtis Mooney, I think he's telling the first group of, like, you know, juvenile delinquents they pick up, or people who are not even doing anything wrong, but they, you know, Mooney picks him up anyways because he's pretty much a jerk and a punk. He says something like, "I'm supposed to read you your rights, but you're in Mooney's jail, and it's Mooney's jail. You ain't got no rights."
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, that just goes to show you that John Vernon character, or John Vernon, just he just took whatever lines they gave him, he just chewed them up. I just thought the movie was great, and he really makes the movie real fun. So, anyways, that's kind of my viewpoint. And again, I think that if you haven't seen this movie, somehow it has escaped you. Do yourself a favor, and as I think John would agree, go out and definitely get this movie.
I totally agree with that. And I to be honest with you, the only DVD you can get on it right now is it's part of the MGM Midnight Movies.
Yes.
For the DVD. And MGM has all those Midnight Movies out. I know this one is still in print. You can get it for like $10. There isn't really a whole lot of features. Well, you know what? There's a lot of features on this bad boy.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not too bad. And you can get it for like $6.
Yeah. A couple of deleted scenes, some bloopers, storyboard, theatrical trailer, like I say, 5 featurettes, and an audio commentary with the Chiodo brothers who were responsible for this movie. So, actually, I will say the Midnight Movies disc for, and I know you can get it for $10 if you're not, like, shopping. Like Jason said, if you actually shop at all, you can probably get it for $6. And I have actually seen it. This actually, there were copies of this at Big Lots at one point for $3.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're all gone, though. But Killer Clowns from Outer Space is a great, great, cheesy movie. And I would say one of my favorites from the 80s. I know a lot of people are into the slasher movies, but this was just something totally different. And you know what's really funny is I know the Chiodo brothers wanted to do a sequel, and I don't know whatever happened.
Yeah, I know. I read it. A review or interview they've given, and they said that there's still it still could happen. It's still, you know, there's always that chance, outside chance of it happening.
I think that ship has sailed, dude.
Well, there's always hope. One can hope, can't they?
They could remake it, and then all the clowns could be CGI.
I know, that'd be great. The CGI clowns everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be ridiculous. I'm sure that'd be what would happen if it did.
That's what would happen.
So. But, yeah, I definitely agree. This movie's great. I think that this and Fright Night need to be in everybody's collection for sure.
Well, we just reviewed 2 80s horror films. Neither one of them are slasher films.
Exactly. But I think it's good because a lot of people do the slasher stuff. So this is something that these 2 movies don't really get talked about too much.
We did the slasher stuff on a show. So.
Well, I know. But, I mean, not every show has to be slasher.
No, definitely. I'm just saying. I think it's kind of cool that we did a couple of films here. So, but
right.
Yeah, all right. Well, I mean, I recommended Fright Night, and I'm recommending Killer Clowns. I think both movies are top notch. I think both movies are worth checking out, and they're fun.
Definitely.
So, but we're gonna take a quick break. Are we done talking on Killer Clowns?
I believe so. I'm feeling good about it.
Okay. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be back right after this in the Gut Munchers podcast.
They call her coffee, because if you jab her, she'll cream you.
This is the end of your rotten life.
Coffee, the baddest one-chick hit squad that ever hit town.
All your friends are dead. Why kill them all?
Coffee, she's got a body men would die for. And lately, a lot of them have. Coffee's black. Coffee's hot. And sometimes, as sweet as sugar.
I know what you want to, and you're gonna get it.
Coffee. Always where the action is. A mean kind of super chick who don't take nothing off of nobody.
You want me to crawl? You want to spit on me and make me crawl?
See Coffee. Rated R. Under 17, not admitted without a parent. Look out, Harlem. Here comes Coffee, the godmother of them all.
to the end of the show and you've wasted at least a couple of hours, maybe, I think, maybe 2.5 hours doing the show. I had fun. It was a good time talking about Fright Night, Killer Clowns. These are two good movies. I think we had a good time. Had a nice conversation with my man Ed. Got to talk to one of my favorite directors about some great stuff that he did in the 70s. I know he did Silent Night, Deadly Night, but I'm a huge fan of those wacky documentaries from the old Schick Sun. So I'd like to thank you, my good buddy, Jason, for doing another show. I'd like to thank Steve and Ed for being on the show. I'd like to thank my man, Chuck Sellier, for granting us an interview. You do your thank yous.
I'd just like to thank everybody again for tuning into the show. I'm sorry if you heard my son a few times. That kind of distracted me during the first part of the Killer Clown thing, so I apologize. But like John always says, we do this show for free, so hopefully you can bear with some of the silly stuff that goes on during this.
You get what you pay for, and it's free, so shut the hell up.
Yeah, there you go. I'll try to be more politically correct because I'm so PC. But anyways, definitely check us out, and hopefully you enjoy it. Tell your friends. And I'd like to thank everybody, all the same people that John thanked, I agree with. So that's it. So hopefully you enjoyed the show, and we will be back next month and talking about some more creamy horror exploitation, blaxploitation goodness of some sort, yep. For sure.
Yeah, definitely. And just to finish us up, don't forget to check us out at gutmunchers.com. Don't forget to check us out on the YouTube / gutmunchers. We have new videos posted pretty much every day over there on our YouTube page. We have movie reviews, written reviews posted to our website every day. Weekly webcomic. We have this podcast. We have reviews of books and magazines and comics. We got a lot of stuff, a lot of things happening, and always something new from Gut Munchers. Every day, you can be assured, there's always something new from Gut Munchers. So thanks for listening, and I should also announce, instead of waiting a month for another podcast, you're only going to have to wait 2 weeks, because there's a special bonus show coming in 2 weeks. So look for the bonus show at the beginning of July, and then look for us to be back for our regular show in the middle of July, where I don't think Jason and I have figured out what we're doing for that show, but I can tell you the bonus show will be Ed and I talking about our favorite DVD company, Blue Underground, and about their catalog and some of their titles. So check us out in 2 weeks for that, and then we'll see you in a month with Jason and I back on the regular show. Thanks for listening.
Thanks so much, guys.
Yep, catch you later. Bye.
Later.